Okay, good morning. Our topic, let me go sit down. It's a small little informal group here. So our topic to discuss is the topic of Aguna. It's a tragic story, a tragic topic, and one that unfortunately has insufficient and unsatisfactory solutions to it. But it's an important one to talk about nonetheless, and I'm happy to share with you kind of my perspective and feelings on it and to maybe generate a conversation about, there's so many different angles to talk about it from, but hopefully I'm sure what's at the forefront of all of our minds are solutions. Solutions to avoid it and solutions to resolve the cases of it. Now, the refrain, "Let my people go," is one that we're familiar with, going all the way back to Moshe Rabbeinu, and we'll soon begin Sefer Shmos and the story of the Exodus. "Let my people go," we remember from the rallies that we did to Free Soviet Jewry. And it's really hard to believe that in the year 2013, in the 21st century, the only people to whom we must chant, "Let my people go," are Jews themselves, are recalcitrant husbands who are continuing to chain their wives against their will, preventing them from being able to remarry, and the tragic circumstances of Agunos. It's really something which is mind-boggling, which history will look back at and not understand, and how tragic that we've come so far of Jewish sovereignty in the land of Israel, and of freeing Soviet Jewry, and Gilad Shalit is home, and yet really the only group to whom we must direct, "Let my people go," are these we have a civility statement, so I can't use the words that I want to use to describe these men, but these horrible, horrible, unethical, immoral, terrible circumstances. The term Aguna, in fact, halachically, Chazal, our rabbis, never imagined it being used in this way. The term Aguna appears in the Talmud in reference not to a man who purposefully leaves his wife chained, but refers to the case of a man who goes off to war, a man who goes on a business trip to Medina Sayam, and he doesn't return. And it wasn't a global world as we have today, where, what do you mean, just check his credit card, just check his phone, just check his itinerary, did he check in at the airport, what do you mean, we can track him down, we can find, post it on Facebook and someone will see him. It was a different world and a different time, and somebody went off on a journey and didn't return, you had absolutely no way of tracing them down and knowing even if they're alive. And so when the Mishnah, when the Gemara uses the expression of the term Aguna, it's describing a woman who has no knowledge of her husband's whereabouts, who doesn't have sufficient knowledge to be able to remarry. She can't confidently declare herself eligible, that her husband is dead. And therefore she's chained, therefore she's stuck. She's unable to remarry. The Gemara has a whole discussion, man who drowns, the halachic descriptions of Mayim Sheyesh Lahem Sof, Ein Lahem Sof, the Gemara Nivamos, where you have water where you can see the boundaries of the water, so if a man came out you'd know. Mayim She'ein Lahem Sof, where you wouldn't know if he emerged, so you have to imagine maybe he emerged. And these questions came up. There was we studied after the anniversary of the Titanic, we had a class on it, and we studied a tshuva that came from that time about Jewish women on the Titanic, or whose husbands were on the Titanic. Could they halachically remarry? Could they assume that their husbands had become deceased? 9/11, on the 10th anniversary of 9/11, 2011, we did a class on the Aguna questions of 9/11. I had a friend who I went to YU with who died, who was killed on 9/11. And there were a few weeks where his wife's status was being investigated until it could be determined definitively that in fact he had perished so that she'd be able to remarry. So historically the term or the expression Aguna has not been used to describe someone who's electively holding his wife hostage. I'd like to believe that our rabbis couldn't even imagine such a circumstance. Instead, the term of the halachic status of Aguna applied to a woman whose husband went on a business trip, went off to fight in war. The Gemara, in fact, does have a whole discussion where men would give their wives a get before going to war, and it was a conditional get, that if they would die, the moment before their death, retroactively, the get would be given, thereby leaving their wives divorced, and it was a whole, so if they wouldn't return from war, we can assume the divorce kicked in, and it's a whole halachic discussion of the mechanism, exactly how it works, but again, that's the original expression of Aguna. And just to take an even further step back, I'm sure everybody knows this already, but when a couple have what's called a halachic bond, through chuppah v'kiddushin, when there's a halachic marriage, it can only be dissolved in one of two ways. Either through a get, or through the death of the husband. That's the only way. How does the death of the husband, it's a big question, is the death of the husband leave the wife eligible to remarry because she's no longer married? Does it work through some other mechanism because he's no longer part of the marriage? Believe it or not, this came up in a class we did recently on transgender in halacha. If a man has an operation to gain the anatomy of a woman, does he have to give his wife a get? Or are they automatically, is the marriage somehow annulled because there's no longer a male participant in the marriage? So it all depends on how you view the institution of a get to begin with. But in any case, again, there's two ways a woman is single again, either through a get, through receiving a bill of divorce, or through the death of her husband. So this term aguna is only relatively recently applied to the circumstances that we're going to talk about, which is a man who refuses to give his wife a get. There was a survey in 2011 which identified 462 cases of aguna between the years 2005 and 2010. So in 5 years alone, close to 500 cases of aguna, the overwhelming majority of whom were under 40 years old. Under 40.
Is that in the States?
That was in the States, yeah. So, again, whatever age, it's a terrible tragedy. But you picture these young women whose whole lives are before them, their childbearing ages are before them, and their husbands are holding them hostage, unable to get married, unable to move on with their lives. It's an absolute tragedy. The leadership of ORA, the Organization for the Resolution of Agunos, we work closely with, confirmed that they've helped 190 women in their short history receive a get. But at any given time, they're working on 70 cases or more. At any given time, they are active on 70 cases or more of husbands refusing to give a get. So it's really a tragic circumstance. And what I want to discuss in our time today are, from my perspective of a community rabbi and my involvement in divorce and in cases of aguna, first of all, at what point is a woman in aguna? What is the natural timing or healthy timing of the progression of a dissolving marriage for divorce? When should the get be given? What can be done? What options do we have in order to put pressure, in order to encourage a man to give a get? And lastly, and most importantly, what can we as a community do to the best of our ability to ensure that these circumstances don't continue, to avoid them moving forward? We wish we had the luxury of ignoring it. 462 cases, 70, okay, it's not my problem, it's not in my backyard. If I don't have a sister or a daughter or a niece, God forbid, who's in aguna, why is it my problem? But as Jews, that's not the way we think. We feel part of our Torah way of life is to think that if there's a Jew suffering, it's all of our problems. And not only is it all of our problems because we are responsible to relieve their suffering, but I would go further in saying that it's a moral obligation, because it's such a poor reflection of us if we are indifferent to the suffering of others. A community that tolerates the intolerable is a community that I don't want to have contact with. So the community, for the community to be willing to accept or be indifferent or apathetic or tolerate behavior that's intolerable and unacceptable, compounds the pain of the victim, of the aguna herself who feels abandoned. Because you know, aside from the agunas I've worked with in South Florida, I was privileged to chair an RCA conference on agunas last year in New York. And when you speak to agunas, a pervasive feeling many of them have is a feeling of abandonment, of isolation, of being alone. Nobody cares. They're suffering and nobody cares. Nobody wants to get involved. Nobody wants to get their hands dirty, including many pulpit rabbis themselves, who really should be at the forefront of leadership in resolving these issues, no matter what it will cost them. The most prominent or wealthiest member of their community resigning or taking back his pledge. If we're principled people, we have to be willing to stand for principle no matter what the consequences. But many agunas describe feelings of abandonment, of isolation, of being alone. And those feelings, Dr. David Pelkovitz, who's a world-renowned psychologist, spoke at our conference on aguna in New York, the RCA conference, and he described research that children of agunos also feel those feelings. Because even when they have contact with their father, but when they recognize or see, observe the pain of their mother, the loneliness of their mother, the hopelessness of their mother, it trickles down to the children. That there is data, there's research that shows the impact on children of whose mothers are agunas. So we can't be apathetic and indifferent, because it compromises our own integrity, because it compounds the pain of victims who are suffering, and that's not what Judaism is all about. I want to read to you a quote from Nobel laureate Holocaust survivor Elie Wiesel. He said, quote, "Of course indifference can be tempting, more than that seductive, It's so much easier to look away from victims, so much easier to avoid such rude interruptions to our work, our dreams, our hopes. It's after all awkward and troublesome to be involved in another person's pain and despair. Yet for the person who is indifferent, his or her neighbor are of no consequence, and therefore their lives are meaningless. Their hidden or even visible anguish is of no interest. Indifference reduces the other to an abstraction. In a way, to be indifferent to the suffering is what makes the human being inhuman. Indifference, after all, is more dangerous than anger or hatred. A Holocaust survivor who survived the worst atrocities known to man describes that indifference is more dangerous than anger or hatred. To be indifferent is to be inhuman. It's to treat the other person, to take away their humanity, to say they don't matter, and to say one doesn't care. And this is also true from a Torah standpoint. The Ksav HaKabbalah, written by Rabbi Yaakov Tzvi Mecklenburg, a great German Rav from a few centuries ago, he makes a great statement on the pasuk that describes the halachic obligation, the Torah, biblical mandate, to care for the orphan and the widow. The widow is referred to as an almana. And the verse, this pasuk, is repeated often in the Torah, that God protects. We say it in our davening every morning, in Pesukei Dezimra. God has an affinity for the orphan, for the widow, for the indigent. And then we have a mandate to protect specifically the orphan, the widow, and so on. So the Ksav HaKabbalah of Mecklenburg says, the word almana, which we translate literally to mean a widow, really means almana, missing a portion. Anyone who's missing something in their life, they're missing their get, they're missing their good health, they're missing the right to their child to get a Jewish education, they're missing friendship and camaraderie. Almana is the prototype or the paradigm for almana. It's a category of all people who are missing something. And the sensitivity and the care and the concern that we're supposed to show to the almana who's missing her portion, so to say, her loneliness, really is a symbol of all those who are incomplete, of all those who are missing something in their lives. So in that backdrop is why we have to care. It's in that background that it must be important to us to be willing to get involved. So what's the appropriate timing of the giving of a get? This is a big question. Unfortunately, tragically, divorce is growing so rapidly. I can tell you as a pulpit rabbi, it's unbelievable. And each individual case, you know, it's not a judgment about divorced people or people going through divorce. There are circumstances where divorce is a mitzvah. The Torah gives divorce as a mitzvah. It's not a mitzvah like putting out tefillin or lighting Shabbos candles, but it's a mitzvah that when circumstances demand it, we have a halachic institution of a get, of gerushin. It's a mitzvah. It's a masechta of Gemara. It's appropriate. And so there are many, many cases of divorce where that's the appropriate and correct course of action. All other alternatives have been exhausted. That's what should be done. So I'm not making a judgment or statement about any particular divorce, just an observation about the trend and about the growing examples of divorce in all of the community and in the Orthodox community. And it's tragic. And the impact studies, I know people like to quote psychologists that it doesn't affect children, but it's not true. And there are plenty of books and psychologists who do. And we need to work on improving marriages before they get to that point. But a couple's getting divorced. So the pendulum has swung a little bit to the extent that I've dealt with certain circumstances where a woman has told her husband, we're done, move out. And by the next morning, she's telling her friend she's an aguna because he says, as he's just first still coming to grips, he's still waking up, he's still recognizing his new reality, or that this is real, he says, I need to absorb this, I need to think about this. And she, I think, preemptively, is declaring herself an aguna, the rabbi doesn't care about me, nothing's happening. So clearly that's very premature. Clearly there's a understandable timeline to giving a get. On the other hand, in the opposite extreme, there are men who there take their time. I'm not ready, I'm pacing, and the civil divorce has come and gone. Maybe a mediation has come and gone with an excellent mediator. Maybe they're long past the custody battles and the division of their assets, and he still says, I'm not ready, I don't feel right. When I'm ready, I'm angry, she said something nasty about me, and he still doesn't want to give the get. And that clearly, to me categorically, is also wrong. By the time a civil divorce is given, a get absolutely, ethically, morally, halachically, should and must be given. The gray area is the area in between. In between the day after she's declared we're getting divorced, and when the civil divorce is final, by which time a get should absolutely be given, there's a little bit of gray area in between. And when I say this gray area in between, let me be clear. My feeling, the position of the RCA, the Rabbinical Council of America, the position I think of most responsible Rabbanim and people involved in this, is that a get should be given at the first opportunity that it's asked for. When it's clear that a marriage is irreconcilable differences and will be resulting in a definitive divorce, and a wife says to her husband, I'm ready for it now. There have been, by the way, I've been involved in circumstances where the husband says, I want to give the get. She says, I'm not ready to receive it yet. Maybe she doesn't really believe the divorce is going to go through. There's a glimmer of hope. Maybe she wants to, there's a victimhood she doesn't mind playing. There's all different reasons. And those are unusual circumstances. At least there, a husband can give a get and put it in escrow with the Beis Din for when she's ready to receive it. So it's not always that it's the husband who doesn't want to give the get. There are times the woman doesn't want to receive the get. But from when a woman decides, or when it's appropriate that the get be given, it's my opinion that the get morally, ethically should be given at that time without delay. The get should never be used to extort. The get should never be used to negotiate. The get should never be used as a tool or a weapon. The get should be given when it's appropriate, when it's clear that the marriage is dissolved. That's when the get, ethically, should be given. If a husband says, I'm going to give a get, you have my word, Rabbi, you have my word, my wife, you have my word, community, I'm giving the get. And you have no reason to believe that I would ever go against that. But I'm going to give it when the civil divorce is final. To me, a get and a civil divorce are the two paired mechanisms through which the marriage ends, and I want them to take place simultaneously. So the position of the RCA, of the Beis Din of America, is that that, barring extenuating circumstances, that that is legitimate. It's not preferable, it's not necessarily the most ethical, but it is legitimate for a husband to say, I'm not using the get as a tool, I'm not threatening that do it my way or I won't give the get, but I'm telling you that I'm most comfortable doing the two together. Both of the mechanisms to dissolve our halachic marriage and our civil marriage, I'll do them together. The position of the Beis Din of America is barring extenuating circumstances like the fear that he will use it to extort or a fear that he's going to flee and we won't be able to get the get or whatever other circumstances, but barring extenuating circumstances, that is a legitimate position. So that's why I say, and by the way, how do you determine if there are extenuating circumstances? So the answer is the address is not the community rabbi. And the address is not the civil court, the address is a Beis Din. A Beis Din. The wife is, and I've encouraged many women, because when we fall into that gray area, there are women who come to me and say, I want the get. I say, look, I went, I met with your husband, I told him that ethically the most appropriate thing, I gave him encouragement, I told him we'd honor him at the shul dinner if he gave the get now, it's the right thing to do. But he says he only wants to give it when the divorce is final, and that's legitimate. And she says, well, I don't think it's legitimate, and I consider myself an aguna. I say, wonderful, here's what you can do. Here's the phone number of Rabbi Weissman at the Beis Din of America. Take him to a Beis Din, a Din Torah. The Beis Din will hear both of your sides, and if Beis Din says, you're right, he should give the get right now, I will do everything in my power from public announcements and rallies and boycotts. But until the Beis Din has determined that now is the time, it's legitimate for him to say that he's going to pair it, he's going to couple it with the giving of the civil divorce. Beis Din is the address to make that determination. So that's in terms of the timing of the get. What's clear is that the get should be given early, because when the get is given, then they're on the same footing. Once the get is given, then they're on the same page. Meaning, if there's a debate about custody, there's a debate about the division of assets, the get shouldn't be part of that negotiation, because then he has an upper hand over her. They should be square, they should be on the same playing field when it comes to this. That's in terms of the timing of the giving of the get. What happens if a man doesn't give a get? What can we do? Rabbeinu Tam, Rashi's grandson, one of the Balei HaTosfos, we have an institution that we call the Harchakos to Rabbeinu Tam. Rabbeinu Tam already in his commentary in Tosfos gave us permission to use social pressure to encourage a husband to give a get. Now I say social pressure. You probably read in the news earlier this year when a number of rabbis were arrested for using much more than social pressure. They used something called cattle prods and other very painful means. What?
But they worked.
But they worked. And where did they get that from? That also follows a halachic institution, one that we no longer observe because we live in a country that restricts us from it, and we have a overarching rule called Dina de Malchus Adina. But already we have the concept of kofeno so'acho merotzani, that you can coerce someone until they say they want to. You have to resolve that or reconcile that with the principle that a get given out of coercion is an invalid get. And the Rambam does so because the Rambam says when you're kofen oso, when you coerce him, when you force him, even physically, even violently, you're freeing his inner positive self that wants to do the right thing. So you're not actually coercing him against his will, you're freeing his will from the negative temptation or inner yetzer hara which is holding it back. There are communities that still employ this method. As I said, rabbis were recently arrested for doing so. We don't believe that that's a viable option to do. But we do have the Harchakos to Rabbeinu Tam. We are allowed to rely on the social pressures that Rabbeinu Tam has encouraged us. That can include announcing someone's name publicly and I don't want to say humiliating him. And of course, by the way, there's a hierarchy. You can't unload your final bullet before you've... because then you have nothing left in your arsenal. If you go right to announcing something publicly or rallying or boycotting, you know, you have nothing left, which is also what I've had to tell a number of women who wanted to get immediately when the husband promised he would give it when the civil was final. And I've said, I can announce his name right now. I can do a rally outside his place of work, but then he has nothing to lose anymore. So he has no reason to give you the get. You're asking me to do something that will be too against your best interests. Because if we move right to that pressure, he has nothing to lose anymore. You've gone to your final weapon. And in each and every one of those cases, at least in my experience, the husband was true to his word and gave the get when the civil was given. And had we embarrassed or humiliated or called him a name or given him the status of a ma'agen beforehand, I don't know if he would have, because why should he? He had nothing to lose. So timing of applying these pressures is critically important if it's going to be successful. One also has to follow a strategy. You know, you can't just show up outside his place of work and rally if you've never sat down with him and heard his side of the issue. If you've never tried to work with him to understand what are his hesitations, why is he not giving the get? He needs to understand that you're working with him, you'd like to honor his position, but these are the consequences if we don't get to that point. In other words, the idea is to use the social pressure as an incentive so that it never actually needs to be used. It just looms as a threat to give the encouragement. If you move right to using the social pressure, it may make the rabbi or the shul feel good about themselves. They may feel like they're great social activists or were the hero of the female community, but it's not going to accomplish the goal. And so what's critically important when working on these issues is to keep one's eye on the ball of the goal. The goal is to get a get. The goal is not to be a hero. The goal is not to be a spokesperson. The goal is not to be a celebrity. The goal is to get, to receive the get. So, but once the other options have been exhausted, one can announce names publicly, one can prevent that person from receiving kibbudim or honors, or even attending shul, one can encourage others not to do business, or interact with that individual, or invite them to their simchas, and one can rally. There's a man, I can tell you his name because he still hasn't given a get, Dr. Abisroor, David Abisroor, is a child psychiatrist, and the former chief rabbi of Israel, that's how long this has been going on, it's the former chief rabbi in Israel, Rav Amar, reached out to me because his wife lives in Israel, is actually a prominent position in Israel, and asked me to reach out to this man. And we did, and he has not given the get. And he refuses. He's not an observant man. He's been married to a number of non-Jewish women since this marriage. This marriage lasted a very short time. There were no children. There were no assets. He's upset because she said things to his family members about him. So we ran many rallies. Some of you were there. We brought school buses of children from our local schools. We ran rallies that made it onto the news. More than a dozen rallies. I won't tell you which background he's from or what Middle Eastern country he comes from, but he's a very stubborn man. And I've tried everything imaginable to crack him. Things that you can't even imagine. Family members he hasn't been in touch with in years who contacted me and invited to have a relationship with him if he would give the get. He still has no interest. Countless meetings, rallies, attempts, and we just can't get anywhere. I don't know what's next or what to do. in order to be able to receive a get. But we applied all the pressure that we knew how. We contacted the American Psychiatric Organization to see if they would withdraw his license because he was doing this. They didn't want to get involved, and they viewed it as a religious matter. We brought the school buses of children, and this is an important point because it's a teachable opportunity for the community. Some people might say, why are you getting kids involved? Or why would you want to expose them to this? And the answer is, we're exposing them to the community standing up to defend one of its own. It's a major teachable moment to teach children that we don't let someone suffer on their own. We do everything in our power to interact in order to protect a woman, in order to help her receive a get. Tragically, in that circumstance, she is still an aguna. If anyone has another idea, I am all ears for help. There are other circumstances. There's another woman in South Florida. None of these are members of our community, but somehow they've gravitated to our shul and to our community for help. There's a woman whose husband refused to give a get. He claimed that she really did still love him, and if only I can get her to go to X sessions of therapy with his therapist, then the marriage would be flourishing, and that I was doing something horrible by helping her encourage him to give the get. So I said, that's wonderful. So guess what? I'm not the address to determine that. Maybe you're right. Maybe she has mental problems and she needs a therapist and she needs medication and really you're in a healthy marriage. So we got the Beis Din of America involved. The Beis Din heard the case, heard his side, heard her side, heard other experts, and said, of course he needs to give the get right now. She's of sound mind. She doesn't want to be married any longer. She's entitled to the get. So he still refused to give it, and I began an online campaign because he had a certain public persona that he was proud of and felt that the most vulnerable spot to hit him was Twitter and Facebook, was online. The Sun Sentinel did an article about it. I'm not proud because that aired our dirty laundry publicly, so to say, but I am proud that it aired the fact that our community doesn't tolerate the intolerable. So we placed a lot of pressure through social media and newspaper articles. Ultimately, he did give the get. He called me the night before to tell me he was giving the get, but I should know that it had absolutely nothing to do with anything that I did. I said, that's perfectly fine with me. I'm 100% okay with that. He gave the get. He continues to post things on blogs about me and leaves me threatening phone calls once a month about my children and everything else. But it has nothing to do with me. God bless him. Hashem should just help him have good health and happiness. He gave the get, which was the right thing. So there are means that we have to add that pressure. They are social media, they are social pressure, they are rallies. Financially, Israel, they have even more means. Because in Israel, when the Beis Din or the court determines the get should be given and it's not, they can cancel a driver's license, they could cancel a medical license, they can take someone's passport so they can't leave Israel, and they can even put someone in jail. There's a man who's been in jail in Israel for over 30 years because he won't give his wife a get. He has to be severely mentally disturbed that he prefers to be in jail than to give her the satisfaction of having a get and being able to move on. So there are mechanisms that we have, more powerful ones in Israel, there where the legal system is operated within a Jewish framework, than that we have in America. But when we do have those options, a community should stand up. And as the Elie Wiesel quote I read before in the Ksav Kabbalah of Mecklenburg, not be indifferent. I'm proud of our community. When we have rallies, we've had tons of people show up. People give money to help us get the buses to bring the students over. When we've had social media, people are reposting and writing. Community can't be indifferent, but has to stand up and has to be willing to help in every way that it can. Yes?
I had heard that if the ketubah is investigated and the eidim were not kosher eidim, then the marriage was not a correct marriage.
Oh, so let's move to the final part, and then we'll take more questions. The final thing I want to talk about is how do we avoid aguna? So there are a number of recommendations out there which are noble in their intent, but which have not met the wide or warm acceptance of the poskim, of the halachic community. So there is one which is the annulment of marriages, that says the woman never would have married a man if she knew about him that he wouldn't give a get. Therefore, it is a Mekach tos, it's kedushei tos, it's a wedding under false pretense. She thought she was marrying an ethical person. He's proven to be a lowlife. So she was missing information at the time of marriage. Retroactively, it's annulled, and in that way, a woman will go free. There are halachic arguments within it, and it's nobly proposed, but it has not met the barometer of the halachic community who have rejected it, including Rav Soloveitchik when he was alive, who took a very strong stance on it, and many others. It is not widely accepted. If there are circumstances where a wedding is not halachically done, then in fact they're not halachically married. You should know there's an opinion of Rav Henkin Zatzal, Rav Henkin, a great posek of America in the last century, who believe that a get needs to be given even when all there is a civil marriage. In other words, the get is not only a requirement when there's chuppah v'kiddushin, but a get is a requirement even of civil marriage. And we give a get l'chumra in that circumstance, but that wouldn't be enough necessarily to call a woman an aguna. You could rely on the other opinions that if there's no valid wedding, then there's no need for the get, the woman is considered to be single. What makes a wedding invalid? So if there are not valid witnesses, if the ring didn't belong to him, so on. There are circumstances where the wedding wasn't valid. I recently read online in this young community who are very forceful about these issues, particularly Aguna, of a young girl who, when she got married, intentionally sabotaged the halachic status of her wedding without anyone knowing, so that she could never be left in Aguna. She'd rather live her life without a halachic chuppah kiddushin, going to the mikvah so there's no violation of Isurei Kares, but she's not technically halachically married, thereby leaving a loophole. Should the marriage ever dissolve, he could never leave her in Aguna because they never had a halachic marriage. This is a frum girl who did this.
How did she?
By making sure that one of the witnesses wasn't valid, the witnesses were related to one of them, a circumstance where the wedding was invalid. So that is a means, but unfortunately in frum circles, in observant circles where people have halachic weddings, because at the time, when they get married thinks they're going to get divorced. I'll speak about that in a moment with the prenuptial agreement. But one of the biggest objections to the prenuptial agreement is, this is romance, love, we're about to start a life together. And Rabbi, you're talking to me about divorce? It's so insensitive. What's the matter with you? What's the matter with you? So I've never met anyone who, when they got married, was planning their divorce. When they got married, they planned on being together forever, even when there were problems in the engagement. But if they're following through, they're following through with the expectation they're going to be happily married ever after. So most marriages in an orthodox or observant setting are halachically valid, so that's not going to be a solution.
What happens when a woman doesn't want to give a divorce?
When a woman doesn't want to receive the get?
Yeah.
So the husband can put it into escrow with Beis Din, with the rabbinic court, and the wife can accept it whenever she's ready, if she's ever ready. In the interim, she can't remarry.
But he can
remarry. And the reason is he could remarry even if he didn't give the get.
Yes.
Because biblically speaking, a man is allowed to have multiple wives. From a halachic standpoint, a man halachically can have multiple wives. Rabbeinu Gershom, who lived in the 10th century, instituted that a man could not have more than one wife. He did that for the protection of women whose interests were being neglected by having multiple wives. Sfardim did not accept that because Rabbeinu Gershom lived in Germany. He was Rashi's Rebbe, Rabbeinu Gershom or Hagola, and the Sfardic countries did not accept that ban. But Rabbeinu Gershom put into his ban on having more than one wife, he put a few exceptions. He said if a woman is a moredes, she refuses to accept a get, or circumstances where she's not behaving as an appropriate or loyal wife, in a situation where a woman is incapacitated. We had a circumstance of a woman who had a brain tumor, and she became totally incapacitated, was living in a home, did no longer recognize her husband, and he was very lonely. He cared for her remarkably, he cared for her loyally, but he was lonely, and he met someone, and he wanted to remarry. So Rabbeinu Gershom built into his prohibition what's called the Heter Meir Rabbanim, that if 100 rabbis living in 3 different locations all agree and confirm that the circumstances are appropriate, with their signatures, they allow him to be able to marry more than one wife.
What about a man if he is in that condition?
Unfortunately, let me just finish. So if a man has a Heter Meir Rabbanim, these 100 signatures, he can be married. So this man in our community, his wife since passed away, his first wife, remarried. He had 2 wives. He was a polygamist, halachically. And he obviously didn't have civil marriage to both. That's impossible. That's not legal. But he had halachic marriage, which is not illegal in the state of Florida. I confirmed it before performing the ceremony. He had a halachic marriage to the second wife, but the Beis Din, even in those circumstances, made sure to protect the interests of the first wife, who was incapacitated. So for example, he had to put a significant amount of money in escrow that the Beis Din knew would be an escrow that would care for the first wife. He had to commit to continuing to visit her and provide the nurses and aides to the same extent that he had previously. And he did all of those. He met all of those obligations, and he was able to take advantage of this heter mei rabbanim. A woman doesn't have that option, because while biblically a man can have more than one wife, biblically a woman cannot have more than one husband. Now, the reason for that is somewhat simple. It's because of maternity and paternity, to know the identity of a child. If a man has more than one wife, one still always knows who is the parents of that child. But if a woman has more than one husband, it's unclear who the parents of that child are. So a woman can only have one husband at a time, and therefore that option of the heter mei rabbanim is not a solution that's available to her. So what can we do? What other solutions are there, and what should we be encouraging, and what can we be promoting? So the most successful solution, in fact it's had 100% success rate, is the halachic prenuptial agreement. Basin of America reports that in every circumstance where a couple had a halachic prenuptial agreement, she was not left in aguna. It works, and it works 100% of the time. And what is a halachic prenuptial agreement? This halachic prenuptial agreement that the Basin of America uses, by the way, is supported by poskim from Rav Zalman Nechemya Goldberg, who was Rav Shlomo Zalman's son-in-law, Rav Avadi Yosef Zecher Tzadik Levracha, was written by Rabbi Willig, Rosh Yeshiva at YU. It has a broad range of support, and fascinatingly, if you're following modern times and you're seeing the offspring of some major rabbinic families who are currently holding their wives hostage, and their families and their institutions being brought into a very public light, you'll see that in the more right-wing world, they're going to become more and more open to this halachic prenuptial agreement. Because as aguna strikes their world more and more, this solution will present itself as really the best and most viable one we have. So what happens is a couple sign a halachic prenuptial agreement before their marriage. This is a document which is civilly binding. It's binding in a secular court. And what it states is two things. It assigns a beis din, should there be a conflict, that they in advance assign the beis din that they will turn to, and that they, through the signing of the document, pledge that they will observe whatever the determination of the beis din. So by the way, that part is not controversial. There's no halacha controversy. There's no reason every chassid, Haredi, yeshivish, yeshiva university, open orthodox, from every stream of Judaism, that everyone can't sign that part. For a couple before they're married to sign a civilly binding, it's essentially a binding arbitration document. It says, should we have conflict, here is our arbitrator, and their decision is binding upon us. It's a classic binding arbitration agreement. And even that alone would resolve this. The second part of it that the RCA has introduced, the Beis Din of America, says that if the husband refuses to give the get after the Beis Din has determined that he should, he will pay her $150 per day that he doesn't give the get. You could fill in any amount, $1 million a day. But it becomes financially prohibitively expensive to continue to deny the get. You may want her to suffer, but you have to afford to be able to want her to suffer at that rate. So, and that's legally binding. In other words, because it's a binding arbitration, it's a civil document, if Beis Din determines the get should be given, she can go to a civil court and claim the $150 per day. They'll put a lien on his property, on his car, on his salary, and so on and so forth. In every circumstance there was a halachic prenuptial agreement, Ora, the Beis Din of America report, the get was given. Because there was this civilly binding obligation to do so. So if we can create a circumstance where every couple getting married signs the halachic prenuptial agreement, there will be no more aguna cases. I signed, it was before it was even popular, I signed the halachic prenuptial agreement. I never have any intent of divorcing my wife. I'm pretty sure she doesn't have any intent of divorcing me either. We did so not because we were protecting ourselves. We did so because we wanted to make a statement that we were going to participate. If everybody does it, then nobody will be left in aguna. I insist, when I'm performing a wedding, that the couple sign the halachic prenuptial agreement. And I think more and more rabbis will insist that they do, and not officiate without, then people will have no choice but to do so. Again, so why don't they? Why do they hesitate? Yes? I don't know if Israel has a halachic prenuptial agreement. Again, they have much more biting sanctions, so to say, after the fact. But I don't know of a similar agreement in Israel. The usual reluctance is because, what are you talking about divorce? We're getting married. Why would you talk about that? I don't know, maybe they have a more yeshivish relative or a rabbi or they themselves, and they it's novel to them, and chadash asam in a Torah, they're not used to new things. They're not really rational arguments against it. Any lawyer who looks at it will tell you it's a very benign document. It's a binding arbitration agreement. It's really benign. From a halachic standpoint, major poskim supported it. So it really should not be controversial, and I think it's going to be less and less controversial, and it'll be embraced more widely as time moves on, because this is the most viable solution. If everyone signs a halachic prenuptial agreement, then we can eliminate the cases of aguna. Ora has a great campaign, where maybe we'll put up a sign in the shul: friends don't let friends get married without a halachic prenup. Friends don't let friends get married. Could you imagine if a group of friends said, we're not coming to your wedding if you don't have a prenup? That would also be great. If friends said, Mazel Tov, we're so excited for you, but we're not coming to each other's weddings. None of us will go to one another's weddings unless you sign the halachic. Not because of you, because of our friend who's still in Aguna, who that never would have happened to if everyone signed the halachic prenup. So, shuls should put into their bylaws that people who are not giving a get, not people who don't give the prenuptial agreement, that I think would be a little radical, but people who don't give a get shouldn't be able to be members or shouldn't be able to receive any honors. Communities should host, we're hosting later this year, a postnuptial party. We're having a big party. I think we tried to make it coincide with Tu B'Av. No, it's before Tu B'Av. I don't remember. It's in the brochure. What's a postnuptial party? You can have a halachic postnuptial agreement also. Married couples who are married for 50 years can sign this halachic binding arbitration that says if they'd ever get divorced, the same mechanism that I told you about earlier. Why would you sign that if you've been happily married all those years? Again, to make the statement that as a community, we are putting in place the power of this document, the power of this binding arbitration agreement. So we're having a big postnuptial party. Everyone could come in their wedding clothes. We're going to have big champagne. It's going to be a big simcha. And couples who are married for many years will sign postnuptials, again, to promote and to increase and to make this statement that we're going to eliminate just as much as we can. So this is a little bit about the case of Aguna. Again, our rabbis never imagined that it would apply to men who electively put their wives in those circumstances. We can't be indifferent or apathetic. We have to stand up and do everything we can. That includes social pressure, includes social media. But we have to be wary of the timing. We have to negotiate and navigate very carefully and sensitively and respect different opinions and always have the goal in mind, the goal being to receive the get, not to be a hero. And we have to be prepared to exert whatever pressure necessary. And the best way, the most viable way to eliminate this moving forward is we encourage people to sign halachic prenuptial agreements. Questions?
You said you solved 70 cases.
No, I didn't solve 70 cases. More, 190 cases.
And they have 70 each year.
190 cases of women who came and said, my husband's refused to give a get, and they get involved through pressure, social pressure, through being a mediator, navigating certain things. Their involvement.
And it worked when it did.
190 cases, it works? Yeah.
The biblical source that makes it so difficult to change the Aguna law.
Yeah.
What is that? Where does it come from?
The Nasam LaSefer Krisus. The Torah says that when a couple want to get divorced, he has to give her a bill of divorce.
It says in the Torah.
In the Torah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the marriage is only dissolved when he gives a bill of divorce.
And it's from the Torah. That's
from the Torah, the biblical law. Yeah. As much as great as the rabbinic will may be, there is not a halachic way. I didn't mention this, and I'm glad you raised it because I should. Rabbi Soloveitchik said that with the acceptance and faith and belief that there is God is the acceptance that we sometimes have to submit ourselves and concede that there are things we won't understand. Rabbi Soloveitchik famously had a case where a young couple were engaged and in love, and then his grandfather died, and they went, or a family member died, and they went to the cemetery, and he saw on the headstone the symbol of Kohanim, of priests. He had never realized he was a Kohen. There was a big problem because she was a convert. A Kohen is prohibited from marrying a convert. And they came to him to ask what to do. And he told them, come back to me tomorrow, I need to think about it. His shamash, his assistant, said, like, Rebbe, it's a pasuk in the Torah, there's nothing to think about. He said, I know, but I had to prepare myself to bring myself to be able to give them that answer, to tell them that. And he said there are times that we have to submit our will. Religious man, generic man, women's health and halacha day, religious woman must submit her will to the will of the Almighty. that with the belief that God exists is the acceptance that there are things beyond our understanding. So that doesn't mean we throw up our hands and say, okay, so there's going to be agunos we can't understand. We do everything within our power, but we have to recognize the boundaries of our power. And our power does not enable us to change law. So you'll ask, what about Hillel's Prizbol, and what about the Shabbos elevator, and what about the countless examples? Those are in within the rules, within precedent, within the halachic system. So we have to operate within the system, and that's what this halachic prenuptial agreement is, a very creative solution within the system. But we're limited by the boundaries of the system, and if we go outside the system, we may feel good that we've come up with a solution, but it's created a whole other set of problems, that we've just violated the system. So those are the limitations that we have. One group is not any less sympathetic than another just because they're not willing to adopt certain approaches to the issue. So, you know, again, we have to, when it does take place, we have to put tremendous communal pressure as much as we can. We have to show up at rallies and social media and marginalizing people and making them feel they can't have it both ways. They can't not give a get. Look, the prominent case that's out there right now, it's because of public pressure that Art Scroll, they're no longer working at Art Scroll and may not be able to go to the yeshiva they were going to. There's tremendous pressure. And that's what should happen. The Jewish community needs to ostracize those who are behaving in intolerable ways. And only then will they recognize that you can't have it both ways. If you want to act intolerably, then you won't be tolerated. You can't be a member of our greater Jewish community. But we can avoid all these issues to begin with if we only... So as parents, we should encourage our children. Friends should encourage their friends. I'm not coming to your wedding if you don't use the prenuptial agreement. Rabbis should declare that they won't officiate if the prenuptial agreement is not used. Even guests can say, the guests of the parents can say, I don't attend weddings unless I know the couple signed the prenuptial agreement. It sounds pretty radical. You could ruin friendships over it. I'm not saying it should be applied universally, but it's something to think about, how we as a community can get to a point where 100% of the young couples getting married, or any age couples getting married, use the halachic prenuptial.
Are the rabbis in the community supporting this outright so that they know that this is an important option for them to consider?
The halachic prenup?
Yeah.
Depends which rabbis. More and more are doing
it. That would be very important.
Absolutely. More and more rabbis are encouraging it and are asking for it.
Would you marry a couple that wouldn't serve?
No.
You wouldn't.
No. Yes.
I just want to thank you that you put it in perspective of the halachic prism that we have to work within, and yet at the same time you're
right.
So progressive about doing something about it. That's
within the limitations.
No, I'm saying it's really what very well put, because rarely do we see that.